Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is Scott the Cow Guy Shalady, Fox Business regular. Scott,
good morning.
Pleasure. Yeah. You and your Holstein splendor with us. We appreciate it. All right. So it's good to have you here on this day after President Biden's big speech on infrastructure, in quotation marks, $2 trillion worth of it, because now is the time to, you know, build back better and so on and so forth. Here it goes.
Now it's time to rebuild. Even before the crisis we're now facing, those at the very top in America were doing very well, which is fine. They were doing great. But everyone else was falling behind. The pandemic only made the division so much worse and more obvious. Millions of Americans lost their jobs last year, while the wealthiest 1% of Americans saw their net worth increase by $4 trillion. Just goes to show you how distorted and unfair our economy has become. You know, this is not to target those who made it, not to seek retribution. This is about opening opportunities for everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And how do you do that?
It's the largest American jobs investment since World War II. It will create millions of jobs, good-paying jobs. It will grow the economy, make us more competitive around the world, promote our national security interests, and put us in a position to win the global competition with China in the upcoming years. It's big, yes. It's bold, yes.
Big, bold, necessary. He's got no problem with people who have made a lot of money, but he just wants to open up opportunities to those who haven't yet, and this is the pathway to do so, Scott.
Well, it brings a tear to my eye. I mean, this infrastructure is just basically going to be stealing. And he comes from a position of, as the left does, you know, that the country is systemically racist and we need to fix it. And there's too many people making too much money and we need to fix that too.
Well, it seems like we have to start from the premises and address those. So one is that the $4 trillion in accumulated net worth among the top 1%. During the pandemic is indicative of how distorted the economy is, how people have been left behind. But in point of fact, as we discussed yesterday with Steve Moore, you know, on a proportional basis, you saw the lowest quintile during the pandemic, pre-pandemic, during the Trump tax cuts, which were supposedly the cause of greater inequality, income inequality. You saw the lowest quintile see their take-home pay increase by 9% and the unemployment rate fall to 3.5%. So they were actually the greatest beneficiary on a proportional basis. And they also saw the greatest reduction on a proportional basis in their tax burden.
Yeah, but those are facts. You're not allowed to bring those up. We still have to talk about our feelings. And to your point about the $4 trillion that the upper class made over, you know what? The government gave it to them. I mean, they shut all the mom-and-pop stores down and let Bezos and Gates stay open. I mean, that's exactly what happened. So here they're the ones that handed the wealthy people even more wealth, and then now they're going to come to your rescue and say that these people are bad because we gave them this money. I mean, it's a circular argument that doesn't make any sense, and they're the ones that keep doing this. They keep causing the problem, and they kind of fake like they're going to come solve it and make themselves look so grand, and it drives me crazy.
Yes, it's Groucho Marx. They create the problem, and then they misapply the wrong remedy.
Right.
Here's the thing. This is an important point, because we've seen this for generations in Chicago and Illinois. You know why we've seen it? Because it works. The innocent bystander routine. We supported lockdowns. We supported the shutdown. We know that it impacts those that have the least latitude and the least capacity to, you know, be thrust out of work, for the kids to be thrust out of school. And then we're going to pretend like all the consequences of that is something that just happened to all of us, rather than it was a choice that we made and supported and continue to support to this day. But those consequences, those are Trump's fault, or those are just, you know, this virus that was visited upon us. And so now we have to spend trillions of dollars that we don't have. We'll just continue to run the printing presses three shifts. And that's the way we're going to make everybody whole. We're going to buy everybody off with the funny money we can print.
Do you listen to the rhetoric? I mean, here's what bothers me. Nobody listens to the words. He says, and this tax hike will bring in $1.5 trillion over the next 15 years. Hey, you just spent $2 trillion last week.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. All these things, they're spending money so much faster than they're going to be able to raise it. And I'm speechless, because driving in this morning, and I'm thinking about, I mean, it almost makes you sick to your stomach about what's this country's become. I mean, do people really listen to what's being told to them? And are they still really, really comfortable with all these social controls? I just don't understand.
Well, do people listen to what they're being told? Yeah, they're listening. Oh, he said jobs. He's going to replace lead pipes. If we replace all the lead pipes in America, we're going to live in Xanadu. That's what he's saying. By the way, there was also a Green New Deal tell in there, too,
yeah,
if you were listening closely. Actually, you didn't need to be listening that closely. It's pretty straightforward.
The American Jobs Plan will lead to a transformational progress in our effort to tackle climate change with American jobs and American ingenuity, protect our community from billions of dollars of damage from historic superstorms, floods, wildfires, droughts, year after year, by making our infrastructure more secure and resilient, and seizing incredible opportunities for American workers and American farmers in a clean energy future. Skilled workers, like one we just heard from, building a nationwide network of 500,000 charging stations, creating good-paying jobs by leading the world in the manufacturing and export of clean electric cars and trucks. We're going to provide tax incentives and point-of-sale rebates to help all American families afford clean vehicles of the future. The federal government owns an enormous fleet of vehicles.
Are you going to translate that for me, please?
It's all lead pipes. He got to lead pipes. It's all lead pipes, charging stations.
By the time
cash for clunkers, or cash for fossil fuelers.
It's the government. By the time they get done building these charging stations, we're going to have a different way to charge cars. I mean, you drive over a pad.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
I mean, it's just such a joke.
Well, you're right. And don't forget rural broadband.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a second.
Right.
But, you know,
and we're going to float a weather balloon.
Here's the thing about it, too. You know, if you spend, it's the seen and unseen problem that the central planners know free marketeers have in terms of communicating with large swaths of the public. If you spend $2 trillion, you know, you're going to accidentally create some jobs. And that's what we see. There'll be a photo op at some electric battery production facility. And people be working and like, oh, I was a West Virginia coal miner, and now I've got this wonderful job thanks to Joe Biden in the electric battery plant. And you won't see the reduced purchasing power of middle income families because of the pass through on taxes of corporations. You won't see that.
It's hard to take a picture of that.
Yeah, right. You won't see the winnowing margins for the middle income families in terms of getting by. And you won't see the displacement of jobs for the losers as so selected by the government. You won't see that. So what we need to do is throw off a few jobs. We'll make up phony baloney stats, just like we do with the Trump tax cuts, the other way for us. And then we'll have photo ops at a couple of facilities that are built with $2 trillion and we'll declare victory just like Obama did and hope nobody notices that you have 8 years of glacial growth because of government excess.
And that's what we're going back to. I mean, if anybody thinks that this is good, it's they're doing everything they can except tell you that here are the tools, put your shoes on, go to work, and we'll back you. They're doing everything they can to do get you money for doing nothing, get you something for doing nothing. Don't worry about it. We'll take care of you. But no, this is just let people go to work, do their job, save their money, and we'll get on with it. But they keep getting in the way time after time by trying to appease you or get you something for nothing. We go backwards, actually. We go backwards.
Here's some of the top spends in the proposal. And again, help me too if this is what you think of when you hear the magic politician word infrastructure. $400 billion towards expanding access to quality, affordable home or community-based care for aging relatives and people with disabilities. Is that a road or a bridge?
No.
Is that has a positive multiplier?
No, they'll probably have them living underneath the bridge. But
yeah. $213 billion to produce, preserve, and retrofit more than 2 million affordable and sustainable places to live. $174 billion for the electric vehicle market. $115 billion to modernize bridges, highways, roads. $111 billion to replace 100% of the nation's lead pipes and service lines. 100%. $100 billion to upgrade and build new public schools. I guess the fact that we're still...
Well, there won't be anybody there getting their way while they do it.
Well, sure, but hey, it doesn't mean we can't create jobs. It's, you know, it's Milton Friedman. It's the Chinese communists build shopping malls that nobody goes to, but we got to keep people at work. Milton Friedman, you want to create jobs? Sure. Instead of people building roads with shovels back in the day, use teaspoons.
Well, no, we're kind of like China now. We're building empty cities.
Yes.
I mean, keep everybody at work. I mean, that's what it is. Six people do the job of one, build some empty cities, pour a lot of concrete. Hey, look what I've done for you.
Amtrak. There's an enterprise that's worthy of continued.
When I think Amtrac, I think efficiency.
Yeah, $80 billion to address Amtrak's repair backlog.
To start over. How about $80 billion to start over? Repair backlog. Really? So does that give you confidence that you're riding on a train that needs $80 billion in repairs?
And that doesn't even include the money for my favorite, high speed rail. High speed rail. California abandoned it. $70 billion in just a couple of years ago. No, we got to resuscitate that. You know why? Because people can't get to Fresno fast enough. All right, we're going to take your calls. Sorry, but we had to get this off our chest, both of us. We'll take your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Go over more of the details here when we come back. Now we check the headlines with Mike Scott.
It's America First with me, Sebastian Gorka, tonight, starting at 10, right before Hugh Hewitt, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, Scott the Cow Guy,
good
lady.
Morning.
And we're talking about the Biden plan to make America's Xanadu. It's very simple, a few hundred thousand battery charging stations, the replacement of lead pipes. We print $2 trillion, make the U.S. number one in the OECD in corporate taxes, shrink the purchasing power of middle-income families, and it's done.
Nothing to see here. Move along.
All right. Very good. Very simple. Very straightforward.
That's a pamphlet, by the way. That's not like a 700,000-page tax binder.
And it, by the way, this is the guy who famously said during the shovel-ready projects era back in the first two terms of the Joe Obama administration. We need to keep spending to prevent from going bankrupt. And he's sticking to that philosophy.
Put simply, these are investments we have to make. We can afford to make them. Or put another, we can't afford not to.
We cannot afford to not spend $2 trillion we don't have. Got it?
Yeah, right.
And here's how he's going to pay for it. Here's the hammering.
So here's what I do. I start with one rule. No one, let me say it again, no one making under $400,000 will see their federal taxes go up, period. This is not about penalizing anyone. I have nothing against millionaires and billionaires. I believe American capitalism. I want everyone to do well. But here's the deal. Right now, middle-class couple, a firefighter and a teacher, with two kids, making a combined salary of, say, $110,000, $120,000 a year, pays 22 cents for each additional dollar they earn in federal income tax. But a multinational corporation that builds a factory abroad, brings it home and sells it, they pay nothing at all.
But hires 1,000 people.
We're going to raise the corporate tax. It was 35%, which is too high. We all agreed 5 years ago it should go down to 28%.
Who's we?
But they reduced it to 21%. We're going to raise it back to up to 28%. No one should be able to complain about that.
No.
It's still lower than what that rate was between World War II and 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Just doing that one thing will generate $1 trillion in additional revenue over 15 years.
Yeah.
There you go. Hold on. Over 15 years. He spent $2 trillion yesterday.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, then he's got another trillion and a half coming from a global minimum corporate tax
so he can spend that next
inversions.
Week. Okay. There
yeah.
we go. Yeah.
By the way, the middle-income family, the firefighter and the teacher – making $110,000. On what planet is that? Are they 22 years old?
You just started, right. With four kids.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but he doesn't take into consideration the $4.50, a tank of gas, each week. He's not taking into consideration everything that those corporations pass through to, whomever's buying their goods and services. That's got nothing to do with it. It's just going to be your tax that you're going to notice. That's it.
It has been calculated by a couple of economists, including Kevin Hassett, also Wall Street Journal editorial board opining on this. Dan Clifton of Strategus Research Partners as well. Doing an actual calculation on the impact here makes this the biggest tax increase if it were to pass in presented form. Biggest tax increase since 1968. As I mentioned in passing, the United States would have the highest overall tax burden on corporate income in the OECD countries.
Bye-bye.
63%. 63%.
Okay, so everybody out there that all the children that voted against Trump, not for Biden, this is what you get. This is what you get when you're that immature that you can't look past the stupid hyperbole and rhetoric and look at the policies. This is what you get, and it's only going to get worse. The teacher and the fireman, they're going to pay more money for everything because of this. They might not pay more in a percentage of their wages, but they won't have to because they won't have any money anyway.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, Brian in Oak Forest.
Hey, good morning, guys. My favorite talking point of Pete Buttigieg and John Kerry and Joe Biden and probably countless others is when they constantly say they're going to create more quote-unquote good-paying jobs. Isn't that a different definition for every single one of us? So who are they to tell us what a good-paying job is? That's all I got.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Appreciate it. Pat in Lockport.
Yeah, good morning. I'm just trying to understand the logic behind this. Basically, I think the best thing that the man could do would be to just shut his senile mouth, open the country, let people get back to the jobs that they had if they're still there, number one. Number two, get back to the businesses that you have worked so hard to develop and perhaps lead to your family. A third question is, if he's going to provide all these jobs, are they going to be allocated to any white supremacists? Or in his ability to unite the country, quote unquote, is it going to be fair across the board? And lastly, what does that imbecile think is going to happen to the job market with the influx of unskilled workers pouring into the country?
Thanks.
Just a couple of questions. If you could answer them before my brain really explodes.
Thanks for the call, Pat. Appreciate it. There'll be a sugar high, at least in the short term, and that's what they care about. I mean, what you're talking about, the corrosive effect of government largesse and these confiscatory tax burdens. You know, that's felt over time. But as I said, the photo ops happen in real time.
Yeah, but this is the issue. This party, they don't want you to believe what your eyes and ears are telling you. And I've been saying that for a long time now. It started with it's a mostly peaceful protest garbage.
Yeah.
But now we are the party. The platform is open borders. That's their platform. But at the same time, they're looking after the working man.
Mm-hmm.
So they're inviting in competition to drive down wages for the people that they say they support. I mean,
This is also, by the way, you heard Biden in a clip we played talk about how this is going to make us competitive and more competitive against China. It's interesting. Tax increases make you more competitive because under his proposal, we would have a higher corporate income tax rate than communist China.
Yeah, we'll be more competitive with a higher. I mean, that doesn't make sense on its face. And number two, I can imagine what Russia and China are thinking looking at us now, because they know that this is an absolute farce and they're licking their chops.
Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Dan, and good to hear you, Scott, again. I'm conflicted over this being an engineer because we need to fix our bridges and highways. But, Dan, you addressed some of the topics, but let's reiterate it again. We're what, spending, what, $2.7 trillion, but only a quarter of it is going into infrastructure. And then the other data that Scott mentioned, we got to reinforce it. This thing costs, what, $2.3 trillion over 8 years, and we're going to pay it back in 15 years with $1.5 trillion. How does the math work on that? I think we need to reinforce Biden's math and the funding capabilities. And thanks for bringing all this stuff up, and the high-speed rail. It's just unbelievable. That's a pipe dream.
Thanks.
We committed to building the infrastructure for the interstate highway system. We've given up on we're never going to have a high-speed rail here. We're too tied to our cars. Thanks for taking my call again, and keep up the work trying to spread the word on all of this stuff.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Bob. Yeah. Yeah, high-speed rail. It's not just that we're too tied to our cars. It's that you just can't make the ROI work to get to St. Louis 45 minutes quicker from Chicago, for example, or Toledo. I mean, remember the Midwest high-speed rail gambit going back a decade under Pat Quinn when this was all the rage? And now because of the printing press, it's all the rage again. These are just future white elephants.
I mean, look.
This is creating work, not creating wealth.
Right. Yeah, right. It's like, but I think that to the caller's point, I agree that things need to be fixed because we haven't spent the money on them over the last 40 years. But what I would do if I was king, I would let corporations, if they want to fix that bridge and not pay tax, they can fix the bridge and they can name it after themselves if they want.
It's better, better than naming bridges after Bob Byrd.
But I would say, look, you want to fix this highway? Go ahead and call it AT&T Highway and take it off your taxes. I mean, why not just cut out the government altogether? Let the private sector rebuild the country instead of the government. That money has to go through the government so they can get all their paws on it.
Yeah.
Cut the government out. You can name it what you want and we'll take it off your taxes. Good luck to you.
And also so that they can finance their financiers. So, pay prevailing wage to the trades and
right.
so forth.
Right.
right. Yeah. You put this in a market type context and not everybody gets their beak as wet as they would like.
Right.
Jim in Crown Point.
Yes, we have the poor people pouring into this country and you have the rich people shipping their money out of this country. As far as electric, great. But the batteries you make pollute worse than anything you can imagine. They have these batteries that once they're used, they can't do anything with them. So they sit and they're very toxic. So hats off to the Democrats.
Thanks, Jim. Pete and Racine.
Good morning. Say we all knew that eventually Sleepy Joe would have to come out and start campaigning, which he did yesterday. Unfortunately, his campaign speechwriters, one third of it was infeasible that they gave him to read, and the other third, Trump already accomplished, and what makes it even worse is Biden is undoing that third. So it's a real mess altogether.
Thanks for the call, Pete.
Well, you know what I think? I think this is Biden's grand plan to slow the surge at the border by making America such a bad place to be. Everybody's going to turn around and run back to Honduras and Venezuela.
Yeah. Right.
That's, I mean, don't.
Yeah. Come on over. Hey, you like what you see? I didn't think so.
Right. How about this bait and switch? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Honduras isn't looking so bad now, is it? Greg in LaGrange.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you?
Good.
Guys, so it's good to have you on.
Thank you.
Amtrak. Amtrak is the red M&M in the rock and roll contract writer. You know, it's always in one of those bills. You know what's interesting to me?
Well, by the way, just one thing on that too, since you brought up Amtrak. You know, it's not like Amtrak wasn't already enjoying a blank check from the federal government. And this is not even including, but we could include, all of the money we've spent over the last year in these rescue plans and relief plans and so-called stimulus plans that are pandemic related. I mean, you know, all of these public enterprises, and I use enterprise loosely, that word. I mean, they're going to be sitting with like tens of billions of dollars on the positive on their balance sheet just for existing.
We should merge like the post office and Amtrak together and just call it Post Track and see how well we can do it.
I like it. All right, sorry, Greg.
Yeah,
go ahead.
And no worries. And the thing that gets me is evidently President Biden didn't have any discussions with Zeke Emanuel because he's throwing money at old people's homes. Maybe he wants to talk to Zeke Emanuel about what is best for people over 75, right?
Yeah, right.
Scott, the thing that's interesting to me is 2 years ago, Yellen comes out and says our debt burden per GDP is something that should keep us awake at night. And now she's going, go big or go home. Full disclosure, Trump was just as guilty. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
You know where this is going. You know where this is going.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
Thanks for the call, Greg.
Yeah, our debt is 100% of our GDP right now. I mean, and it's going to go more. So we're going to be, you know, like I said, we're rushing to the third world faster than the people are surging the border.
85. I mean, just to give this example concrete, $85 billion for mass transit, plus $80 billion for Amtrak in what Biden announced yesterday. That's on top of the $70 billion Congress appropriated for mass transit in the three COVID spending bills. I mean, this is just throwing around money. You think this is precise? It's funny. It's so precise. You always round to the nearest billion.
Right. And here we have to laugh because if we're not laughing, we're crying because it's so utterly ridiculous.
Sean in Crown Point.
Good morning, Dan. One thing that you don't realize that you and your partner today's show is there's a book that says in the end man won't know his way out, and you're going to see in the end things you ain't never seen before. So just wanted to let you know that.
Okay.
All right.
Sean, thanks for the call. Gonna have to reflect on that. Bill in LaSalle County.
Hey, thanks guys. One of the things they talk about is creating these jobs and, you know, in the urban areas, and they're going to have advocates, you know, so these are those good paying jobs. We're going to just create more government workers, you know, quote, call advocates to help the people find the free money from the government to rebuild the inner cities, you know, which has been happening
sure.
since 1960s.
Sure.
Being an advocate is one of those good paying jobs, I'm sure.
That's right. Thanks for the call. We're just a few community organizers and another Marshall Plan away from prosperity in urban centers.
Even if they're giving out government money via an advocate for you to open up your mom and pop restaurant in a horrible neighborhood, who's going to do that, number one? And let's just say, You're Mother Teresa and you feel like trying to do that. And now you open it up and you fought against everything else to put this business together and they shut you down because of the next virus. I mean, you're on a road to nowhere with these people. Forget it.
Safety first and and transfer payment second. Dan and Scott, the cow guy, in for Amy.
Yep.
Take another quick call on the Biden making it rain with funny money plan. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, hey, Dan and Scott, thanks for taking my call. Listen, everything is exactly the opposite of what this Lion Joe, a.k.a. Beijing Joe, he takes and lies about all this stuff because it's all opposite. And everything. It's all destroying the place. And the people with money and that can afford it, and if somebody's Republican, should make TV ads go on and inform the American people what the heck's going on, how these people are destroying this country, destroying our economy. It needs the word needs to get out. That's probably the most important thing that could happen is get the word out. I got friends at work. They don't know what the hell's going on. They don't even think everything's okay.
Thanks for the call, Craig. And you need to probably pressure some of your less staunch Republicans to not be wooed by the siren song of funny money for their districts or for their states and fold in on this, too, because there's going to be a lot of Republicans attracted to distributing largesse. You know, this is a bipartisan problem in D.C. and in so many state capitals, too. All right. Coming up at 6:06, we'll switch gears. Should we ban sports or should professional sports pull out of Georgia permanently because, you know, they want to have free and fair elections there?
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning is Scott the Cow Guy Shalady.
Good morning.
And Scott, we were talking last hour about the Biden making it rain with funny money, phony money and phony infrastructure spending, $2 trillion worth, and talking about the negative impact of the proposed corporate tax increases in what he laid out yesterday, the president. And I just want to make it clear, lest anyone think otherwise, and this is something perhaps the Republican Party may want to consider doing. This is not because I like corporate America. This is not because I'm rallying to the defense of my fat cat friends in C-suites, the cover propaganda the left uses when you oppose bad economic policies. I find corporate America, generally speaking, detestable. I find the Fortune 1000 CEOs as a group, of course, there are exceptions, but in general, to be some of the biggest cowards and flim-flam men and women on the planet. Okay? So this is no waving the flag for rent-seeking, woke corporate America. This is bad economics isn't visited upon the rich disproportionately. It's visited on middle-income families like the one I grew up in and those trying to become middle-income families or better in this country. That's why people like me, and I would, I don't want to speak for you, but I think why Scott oppose arbitrary, confiscatory, anti-growth tax policies.
Right, and reading some of the reports this morning after yesterday's headlines, some of these things are going to cost us, if you add it up, depending on how you add it up, between 1.5% to 2% of our GDP annually for the next 10 years. So if we're going to grow at 4, it'll be only 2 or 2.5.
And rather than weighing in areas they perhaps know a little bit more about, economics, business, what do we have? We have corporate America echoing the sentiments of Jemele Hill.
Oh, my word.
And calling, well, not quite calling for boycotts of Georgia yet, because some of them are located in Atlanta, but essentially saying that the Georgia legislation, I'm talking about the election reform there, is unacceptable. Delta CEO Ad Bastian, I need to make it crystal clear that the final bill is unacceptable and does not match Delta's values. The entire rationale for the bill was based on a lie, calling allegations of widespread voter fraud, quote, simply not true, unquote. No, Ed Bastian's a elections expert.
Well, I mean, what
Delta CEO.
What does he have a problem with? I mean, that's what I'd like to know. Just sit me down and tell me what you got a problem with.
You know what he has a problem with? 72 black executives, including Merck CEO Ken Frazier, former Amex CEO Kenneth Chenault, Melody Hobson, Starbucks chairwoman and CEO and co-CEO of Ariel Investments. This New York Times ad that was published yesterday pounding on Georgia and their election reform law. This is a nonpartisan issue. This is a moral issue. The former CEO of Xerox, Ursula Burns, another signatory.
I just would like
people are going to have to respond. Companies are going to have to say something. They're compelled to say something about this. And so what are they doing? They're pandering to civil rights groups.
Oh, sure.
Quote unquote. And people like Jemele Hill and Terrence Moore, sports journalists writing at CNN, the sports world should boycott Georgia. The Masters should be moved from Augusta. Joe Biden saying yesterday he thinks and would strongly support Major League Baseball moving the All-Star game out of Atlanta because of the Georgia election law. And so these CEOs are just parroting what they hear from people that can put pressure on them or people from whom they feel pressure, since they clearly feel no pressure nor any fealty to a wide cohorts of their customer base.
I just would like to know what they have a problem with. I mean, just tell me what the issues are, because they're not reported in the press. You know, everybody's been talking about how you can't get water if you're standing in line on a hot day in Georgia when you go to vote, which is patently untrue.
The language in the bill made approaching voters to give them money, gifts, food, or water within 150 feet of a polling location a misdemeanor.
Bribes.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, by the way, with 3 weeks of early voting and so on and so forth, I don't people standing in line to vote on election.
It's a relic of the past.
This is a real problem.
Well, and you know, and here he leans into the microphone, good old Biden. They can't get water? I mean, why doesn't somebody say, no, they can, Joe. They can. Read the fine print. You know, stand. I don't know what to say, because we don't let anybody, we don't want anybody to read. We don't want anybody to know about it. We just want to have the headlines, and we're going to rule on six word sentences. That's right.
This is the sum total of what most people, particularly those corporate shills for the radical left, know, and they're just parroting. Opponents say the new voting rules will make it harder for voters in underrepresented communities to cast ballots. That's basically it. That's basically it. Well, backers say the rules are needed to preserve election integrity.
Well, we don't want that.
Backers say this, and opponents say the new voting rules again will make it harder for underrepresented communities to cast ballots. How? See, they don't want to be specific, in part because then you have to have a conversation on those specifics.
No.
And then you have to defend the position that, wait, a black person has a more difficult time presenting an ID card than a white person?
It's not true.
You're infantilizing black people.
Right.
That's racist, frankly. It's a racist position. But that person doesn't want to expose himself to being the CEO of Delta Airlines doesn't want to expose himself to that conversation because it'll look like the ass that he is.
I mean, they can't. Look, the upper 1% of Americans pay 39% of all taxes, right? The lower 90% pay 30% of all taxes. Now, they can clearly define when it comes to you making too much money, they know the number. But when you ask them what is your fair share, they'll never give you a number.
You know what else I'd like to, the conversation I'd like to have too? At Melody Hobson, how'd you make it? Ken Frazier, how'd you make it?
Right.
The white man? A voting rights law? Or election reform law in this case? How'd you make it in America? You're the CEO of one of the biggest drug companies, pharmaceutical companies in the world. Fantastic. Obviously a smart guy. Ken Frazier, CEO of Merck. How'd you make it? By waiting for a transfer payment?
Waiting
for the next Marshall Plan for the for urban renewal, for urban renewal.
So what held you back? Yeah,
Melody Hobson. Yeah, I mean, you're not 22. I don't know Ken Frazier's particular story, but obviously he grew up in a time where race relations were not as smooth as they are today. And I mean, not that they're particularly smooth, but I mean, sort of by law and culturally. People, I think you could fairly argue, a couple of generations ago, there was less comity between the races than there is, generally speaking. Now, I think there's a lot more comity between the races than you get presented by the media, because the media's job is to inflame racial animus for the purposes of helping their demagogic politicians. you know, their fellow travelers on the left. But I mean, in your day-to-day life, I've said this for years, your day-to-day life, do you have a lot of racially oriented conflicts? I can't think of one I've ever had.
Here's the deal. Exactly right. And I say this all the time. We're not, I mean, I get slammed for saying it, but we're not a systemically racist country. There are people, yes, here and there, just like there's bad NFL football players here and there, right? But you can't paint everybody with the same brush. When you walk into Starbucks, the next time you actually can stand in line at Starbucks, does it ever cross your mind about the ethnicity of the people standing in line in front of you? You don't care. You just want your coffee and get out of there. You're not angry about anybody standing in front of you or behind you. You don't know. I mean, it's I don't understand that nobody picks out race and ethnicity more than the Democrats do, because I literally do not care. I don't even notice.
And I go back to the what I said at the outset, too. So when is there going to be an organized effort to say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to pantomime this anymore. I'm sorry, I'm not going to kowtow to Al Sharpton and the other race hustlers. And that includes those who are kowtowing to them in C-suites, in Fortune 10, Fortune 100, Fortune 1000 companies.
It's just too easy. That's why I hate it. It's like chewing gum for the brain to hop on that bandwagon. You know, you don't even have to think. You just, like you said, you parrot what you've been told.
Yeah, and I don't have to do anything either.
This guy, this Fraser guy's got a law degree from Harvard.
Yeah. I mean, he's the CEO of Merck, for God's sakes.
No.
And Melody Hobson.
Oh, my word.
You know, she was doing well before she hooked up with George Lucas.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay. But Melody Hobson, I think she's still the co-chair or the chairman of the Chicago Economic Club, too. And that's, you know, basically a left-wing organization
now. How can you say Chicago Economic Club in the same
sentence? Yeah, well, exactly. Those two words should never collide in the same sentence. You're right about that. But it's just remarkable. And nobody calls them out on it. They get no pushback. Where's the Republican Party to say exactly what I said at the outset? Here, we support these policies, these economic policies, tax and spend policies, in the interests of American families. I despise the pablum coming from corporate C-suites. What Ken Frazier and Melody Hobson and everybody else who's a signatory on that ad in the New York Times is saying is wrong. They're detestable. The positions they hold are detestable.
Absolutely.
They're flacking for ignorance, and we're not going to be any part of it. And you know what? You're going to suspend your donations to anybody who had a question about the election results in 22. Keep your frickin' money. We yes. don't care. We want the world to know, certainly the American electorate to know, we have no interest in Melody Hobson's money, in Ken Frazier's money, in Bastion's from Delta, Ed Bastion's money.
But if you stand up against them, you're racist. Dan.
Keep your patent. Well, I'm talking, this is white and black. I mean, this court
doesn't matter. They call Ben Carson racist.
Well, that's true. That is true. But I mean, just keep your money. I don't want it. I don't want anything to do with you until you act like an adult if you're going to decide to enter into a conversation about public policy and culture and get out of your lane running an airline or running a pharma company.
So true.
You know, who the frick do you think you are? Lecturing me about election law, lecturing the country about what's right and proper on these matters, Ed Bastion. You know, go take a flight, if you know what I mean. Jerry, Northwest Indiana.
Hey, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I work for one of those companies you speak of, and it's unbelievable the internal memos that come out.
I can imagine.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, anyway, they have this new office of propaganda. I call it this diversity, equity, and inclusion. This is all propaganda. It's being shoved out, but it's all related to money. Because they all get this new rating, this new environmental social rating from the bank. And if they don't get to this certain rating, they don't get the loans to grow their business. So it really is catering to the large banks that are really gripping the corporations right now. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. It's a good point, actually, Jerry. That's the one we can't walk by. Go ahead.
No, because I know friends that bank at certain banks, and now they're getting, it's almost like the Chinese social score. They're getting a score based on their giving, what they're spending their money on, what their credit score is against that, and slowly but surely it's eking into American life the Chinese social score, and that's going to be something that's going to overtake your credit score. It's already happening, and it's now obviously happening at the corporate level. But, I mean, to your point about these CEOs, I mean, how many times have you seen them send out tweets and then have to, come back because somebody thought there was something mildly racist in it when they're saying the truth, right?
Well, I mean, this raises this issue I wanted to bring up with you when I knew you were sitting in, and Jerry provided the perfect bridge here. You know, Bill Ackman, the billionaire yes. hedge fund guy, Pershing Square Capital, I think you have the same opinion of him that mm-hmm. I do based on that sigh. He this week touted ESG investing. This, for those who don't know, ESG investing, environmental, social, and governance mm-hmm. investing. This is the new capitalism, and this is going to be the way out of our problems, is ESG investing. And this is the sort of thing where you look to make sure that, you have a Benetton ad on your board.
It's WOKE investing.
That's what it is. That's what it is.
Yeah. It's 100%. And, it's not new. It's been around for about 3 or 4 years, but it's really now ramped up because of this woke environment that we're sitting in here. And it's as good as woke. That's what it's going to get you. Absolutely nothing.
I mean, it's billionaire hedge fund guys promoting it. So the problem is, right, you've let this get so far out of control that now you're trying to survive as an employee or as an entrepreneur and access to the banking system and so forth. And you're getting hit from all sides with this sort of ignorance.
Right. And so they come out with a statement so that they make sure that they're daughters don't get grief at school anymore because their dad's a big CEO and they come out against it.
Check a box.
Right.
And then go about your business.
Okay, yeah. I can live with my guilt now.
Mike in Melrose Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, this guy from Delta, you mentioned his name. I don't remember what it was.
Ed
but
Bash.
The Delta guy, does that mean if he's opposed to all the voter laws and stuff, so now to fly on Delta, we won't need an ID? Just board at will?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, what about underrepresented communities trying to buy an airplane ticket and board a plane, having to present IDs to TSA? Isn't that too onerous for underrepresented communities, Ed?
He's so full of it.
I know. But nobody calls him out. They're just like, oh, yeah, underrepresented community. He said underrepresented communities. He really cares. No, he doesn't. He does not.
I mean, this is...
He's a sophist. It's sentimental barbarians, one and all. Golly, Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, same deal as far as the traveling. Well, I think we should abolish the TSA. We should abolish driver's licenses. We should abolish anything with our names on it and not even have numbers. And Dan, I don't know what
except our vaccine passports.
I just grunt when I see it because any form of identification is going to be, it's racist. Asking somebody, hey, what's your name? Racist. I mean, this is just unbelievably stupid. Also, about the ESG stuff. So I wonder how they're going to incorporate that into the modern portfolio management courses at places like MIT and other.
They don't teach that
anymore. Throw out your beta. Yeah, throw out your beta. Throw out everything. Throw out the security market line theory. Throw out everything. It's just all about whose ESG score is the highest.
Yep.
Construct your portfolio accordingly.
Yeah, and then get prepared to work until 80 because you're not going to have much of a retirement income if that's the basis on which you're investing. And, thanks for the call, Ralph.
And to that point, it came out yesterday that grading papers on an A through F scale is racist. It's another form of white supremacy.
Of course it is.
Oh, yeah.
It's like sheet music.
So you're
like
now,
Mozart.
So that's what I'm saying. It's just going to go to a social score. That's what's going to be at the top of your paper.
And so how does that work in the investing world then, too? Who you're just going to get allocated money by government diktat based on your investment in the most woke companies? It doesn't matter what their performance is?
Yeah, you're down 48% on the year, but well done. Here's some more. I mean, it's an absolute – there's only one gauge in my business, and it's how much money you make for your investors or whomever is behind you. I mean, if you're going to continue to lose money because you're investing in ESG – are you going to be rewarded with more government money to continue to lose? I mean, they're basically doing that now anyway with, high-speed rail or internet. But every day it keeps getting more ridiculous, Dan, and I keep saying it can't get any worse, and it does. I mean, this is now a train that's not going to stop. And again, for all the children out there that acted that immature and voted against Trump, not for Biden, but against Trump, this is what you get. This is out of control.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now. And make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning, Scott the Cow Guy Shalady.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Scott, I know you're one of the Illinoisans living in exile in Indiana. Understandably so. There is a couple of candidates now announced for governor in Illinois, Republican, to challenge Governor Jelly Belly in 2022. And one of them, who announced earlier this week, is Gary Rabine, who I know fairly well. I'm a member at the club he owns, Bull Valley, up in Woodstock, which is a great course, great membership group too. Actually, he has this unwritten policy. He told me when it went up to play golf with him, considering joining. He's like, we have a no a-hole policy here, which is great. I mean, it speaks to what a regular guy he is, even though he's done some very irregular things in terms of his success in business. He's really a decent guy. He is a super likable, decent, high-energy guy, which is why I advised him not to run for governor.
Exactly.
Actually want the best for him. But he's decided to do it anyway because nobody listens to me in Illinois. We'll now find out why. Gary Rabine joins us. Gary Rabine, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Dan, thanks for having me. Scott, nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you. Good morning.
So, Gary, I think we have a pretty good handle here on the case against Governor Pritzker. Your value proposition as a candidate, how do you frame the race?
Well, for me, Dan, I see craziness, right, in leadership, and I've seen it in business all my life, and that's where I see opportunity in business to grow business, right? Well, I'm seeing craziness as far as leadership in government right now and J.B. Pritzker. Really no conscience of small business and the working person, in my opinion, and that's got to change.
And so, you know, your story, a little bit of the Reader's Digest version of your bio and how you came to this decision to, you know, to be the guy, to be the change you wish to see, so to speak.
Yeah, Reader's Digest. I'm 40 years in business. I started it right out of high school in the paving business, started driveway paving. I was in the field for about 20 years, paving driveways and parking lots, laboring, driving truck and all that, which I actually love doing. But I figured out how to scale my business about 20 years in, and the last 20 years has been about scaling business and being an entrepreneur. We built many companies in this time, about 30 different businesses that we started and grew, and you know, some died off because they weren't as good ideas as we hoped. Most of them have been very successful, though. We've grown across the country with our businesses, and in that time, Dan, the last 15 years, I've been traveling the country to understand what customers we serve across the country. And we've grown to be able to pave parking lots and concrete and asphalt in every state in the country. I've learned a lot of lessons of the best states to work in and kind of why, right? Mm.
And, one thing that I want to make sure people know about you, just in terms of like, oh, is it going to be another, like, here's a guy, first-time candidate, a successful businessman. We just went through that and we got burned with Bruce Rauner, especially if you're a conservative. Well, Gary supported Bruce Rauner in 2014, excuse me, just as, you know, we all did as the nominee against Pat Quinn. But then in 2018, after Rauner betrayed the Republican Party and particularly conservatives on so many issues, he switched and supported Jeanne Ives. And I think that speaks to being a man of principle and not just a go-along, get-along guy, which, of course, we've had too much of in the Republican Party for, I don't know, the last 50 years.
Yeah, I like Bruce Rauner, and I thought he had all the right stuff going on. Two bills he passed, the sanctuary state bill and the HB 40 abortion bill. Right? Those two bills really turned me away from Bruce because I never would have imagined in everything I learned about him that he was going to do anything like those two things.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, give us sort of your policy platform at a high level. I mean, what are the things that are going to animate your candidacy and would be sort of your first priorities if elected?
Yeah, so first and foremost, I mean, I've learned to understand best climates to create jobs in. And over the last 15 years, I've been involved in Republican Governor Association, Job Creators Network, and Turning Point USA, and some other groups, leadership groups across the country, I've watched Illinois from 15 years ago really being probably the number one place in the Midwest to start a job, go find a job, grow a business, right? And to being today the worst. And over that time, states have gotten smarter. Indiana's done great things to make their state, very, very job and business building friendly. Tennessee is incredibly strong right now with some good leadership, good governance there. Of course, we have Texas and Florida who continue to take thousands of jobs of ours a year. So for me, number one is job creation. I believe that with some simple changes in policy, simple changes in litigation, workers' compensation laws and things like that, I think we can take it from losing 50,000 jobs a year to gaining 50,000 jobs a year. That's a start. When I look at property tax, Dan, and we look at this property tax environment we have in Illinois, as you probably know, I've heard you talk about it before, it's crazy, right? We're number one highest now in the country. 15 years ago, Dan, we were kind of average. We're just above average, actually. Now we're the highest in the country. And so what are we doing there? Scott, I'm guessing Scott moved to Indiana. He's finding a feeling of comfort, and they like him because he's paying 1% of the value in property tax compared to across the border where he might have been paying 3%, 4%, even 5% in Illinois. Then lastly, my third thing really is serving families like we're not doing currently. We're not giving families in Illinois the safety they need that they can raise their kids in comfort in. We're not giving families the education. Teachers in Illinois aren't there to teach the students. They're there to be served instead of served. And lastly, I look at, again, all this thing rolls up to when I raise my kids, I want to be able to look at them in the eyes and say, kids, here's the place to raise your family also. And families today don't see that the opportunity for their kids are here. They have to actually tell their kids. I hear it every day. Hey, this is not the place to raise your family. Maybe Indiana, maybe Wisconsin. Florida's nice weather. Texas. We're not hearing any families confidently saying to their kids, this is the place to raise your family right where we raised you, right? So, those are huge deficits, in my opinion. When you don't serve the family, you're going to lose your state.
Well, you know what? Those are all great things. I just, I am in Indiana, and I left. I mean, my real estate tax was exorbitant. It was more, I'm not going to say the number, but it made your eyes water. And a lot of folks are leaving the state because of that. And that's probably the only wealth left in the state is actually real estate wealth. And the state's going to have to go after it because, I go into the city 2 to 3 times a week to film and to shoot my hits for Fox. The city's dead. Chicago is going to take a long time. I know a lot of people are bullish and think it's going to come back tomorrow. But you know what? With the CEOs not demanding that people come back to the cities or come back to the office, it's going to take a long time. So I just kind of feel like you're going to have to do something huge in Trump parlance because you could only be like Captain Smith, the caretaker of the Titanic, and all you're going to do is just rearrange the deck chairs. I mean, what is going to pull Illinois and Chicago out of the downward spiral that they're in because they're having to borrow more and they're having to pay more to borrow more? I don't see how, and that's why they're coming after the real estate, because that's the last bastion of money in the state that they can go after to help get themselves out of the problems. So I think it's a daunting task, and I wish you luck, but I think that there's some serious, problems with trying to turn around something that is going 80 miles an hour in the wrong direction.
Yeah, Scott. So, great point. I mean, we're looking, when you look at, our pension debt, it's the highest in the country. When we look at pension debt, we're the highest in America right now. And it's not like a little high, right? We're higher than California, New York, or all the other stupidest states. We're higher. So when we say that, something's got to be done. I mean, we can't spend 50% of our income.
Yeah, you can't pay it. Debt. You can't pay it.
And we can't do anything else. Nothing else can get done, right? Mm-hmm. So I mean, and it's not like we're at 50% and it's going to go to 20% in the next 5 years. We're at 50%. It's going to go to 100% in the next 10, 15 years, right? So again, those numbers of course don't work when you're only serving less than 10% of our economy, right?
So that's got to change. And well, until we have the courage to do that, we're in trouble.
Well, courage is the right word. But here's the thing. You know, we're talking about this like actuaries, unfunded pension debt and so on and so forth. And, you know, we've been doing this as conservatives in this state for a long time to no particular avail. I mean, partly because so many so-called Republicans are on the public sector union dole, too. So there's sort of an inertia problem, an enemy inside the perimeter problem. But there's also a messaging problem. And, what is the messaging that's going to galvanize people, especially now that you've given the federal government, the Biden administration has given Pritzker a 2-year reprieve by drop shipping $25 billion to states and localities here. So now you've pushed off the reckoning just a little bit longer and it'll make it that much worse. But nonetheless, people won't see that. Pritzker will be able to preside over everything's fine. We didn't have to raise taxes, even though I tried. Because of this bailout from the federal government. So what is the case that you make? How do you synthesize this for the electorate?
So Dan, you know, that's an awesome point. I believe that, you know, we continually tell the taxpayers of Illinois and the pensioners of Illinois that there's no problem. It's all good, right? Until we message well, like the left does, right? Until we message really well, explain the crash coming going forward, mm-hmm. Even with this $25 billion bailout, until we message really well, we're going to lose this thing, and that's something we've got to do, and I'm all over that. I mean, I look at a pie chart and just say, okay, we're at 50-55% of our debt right now our income is going to this pension debt. 50-55% is the number, right? Okay, of course, there's nothing, and we're only showing like 28% because, you know, half of that or a little less than half that is going to, you know, just piling on the long-term debt. It's still costing us, whether we want to call it that or not, at 50-55%. All right. If we look at the competitive states across the country, the average is like 3%. Okay, look at Indiana. About 3% of all their income goes to their pension or their retirement funds for their public sector, and they're not growing. It's not growing at all. They're stable at that. Okay.
Yeah, but
how can we survive? Right.
But here's the thing, Gary. It turns out, at least from recent election returns, the majority of Illinoisans don't care about other people's pension, even when it comes at the expense of liquidating their home. They are not connecting those dots, at least not until they go to sell. And then by that time, they're out the door and they're no longer on the voter rolls. And so they've learned a hard lesson, but it doesn't do anything to change the trajectory of Illinois. The whole, like, we got to create jobs, we got to reform pensions, we got to cap, a hard cap on property taxes like Indiana, or cut it by 50%, which is, you said. You know, that just doesn't have mass appeal, according to recent election returns. Now, I know, you know, our last three gubernatorial nominees, you know, two Democrats and a hapless doofus are not necessarily the best messengers for these issues. I got it. But there seems to be something more to galvanize people. And I wonder about taking up some of these fights that are going on now at the local level on moral issues. And fairness issues like transgender issue with female sports and other moral issues that are front and center, that where you've got a supermajority of people that support the conservative position, and yet so many conservatives that are unwilling to debate it, much less advance it. And there has to be more, especially when you talk about your third prong there, you know, being supportive of families.
Yeah, no, I mean, so when it comes to social issues, in my opinion, it's landscaping in the backyard. If we don't take care of the fiscal issues, and the house is burning right now. The fiscal house is burning. We got to go after that. Now, back to that subject you just mentioned, my sister was a U of I athlete, very competitive athlete, and I've had a conversation with her recently, and she said it would be crazy to be able to think that you have to compete with men, right? Transgender in college sports. There's no way that you know, she was a great athlete. There's no way she knows she couldn't have done it. Would have been playing most likely. But either way, that's crazy to think that we're okay with that, right? But when we look at the social issues, Dan, I look at, we have a house that's burning down right now. Landscaping in the back are all the social issues. Not that we stay away from them. We don't address those crazy ones, right? But boy, if we don't go after this fiscal house that's on fire, we have nothing left. We're not going to live in it to enjoy landscaping anyway.
Well, that may be true, but I don't think it's true. Actually, I mean, I just should state my claim. I don't think it's true, but regardless, the packaging is still an issue. And again, this packaging has been tried. What you're describing, and I know you're going to be a more likable guy than nominees we've had in the past, with a better story than nominees we've had in the past. But I still think that this sort of, you know, green eye shade stuff. It just kind of reciting statistics and saying this is not sustainable, that is not going to be enough to carry the day. I mean, I don't think so.
I 100% agree with you. It's not. If we don't have great messaging and we don't invest in great messaging right now to go out, and it shouldn't be just one candidate going after this. It should be all candidates that are aware and are using the same messaging. And everybody that cares about Illinois should be understanding and using that same messaging to educate everybody on the danger ahead that nobody's, and most people aren't aware of, right? We're not telling the story. Nobody talks about the $420 billion combined pension deficit, unfunded pension right now. $420 billion, not $150 or $200 billion that you'll see if you look it up, because that's just the state. Add up Chicago, add up the counties, right? And you know, nobody's seeing all that. And pensioners, God bless them, they're there, you know, really working hard to get that pension in the long run. And they think it's coming to them, whether it's a $100,000 pension or it's three pensions for $450,000, they believe it's coming. But it's not sustainable. And if they don't understand why, we're going to deplete the value of every job, every property in Illinois before you're ever able to pay it all.
All I would say is that the entire message of the left, including the leftists in Illinois, is pro equity and anti hate. It is just rinsed and repeated all the time. And unless that is challenged frontally, I don't see any Republican making any progress.
I got an idea, Gary. You sound like a good guy.
He is.
So, I think that the way that you could solve all this is pretty simple. Just move to Indiana and run for governor there.
Right, exactly. Or get Holcomb to annex Illinois, as I'm always wanting Indiana governors to do. Gary Rabine, the website rabineforgovernor.com, Rabine, R-A-B-I-N-E, rabineforgovernor.com. Get more information about Gary and his candidacy if you want to get involved. Gary Rabine, thanks for joining us. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again throughout the campaign.
Thanks. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Scott. I appreciate your time, guys.
All right.
And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is Scott the Cow Guy Shalady.
Good morning.
You see his work regularly on Fox Business and on our show. We're happy to have him. Scott, we were having this conversation with Gary Rabine before Mike Scott's newscast last hour, and I was pushing back a little bit on the messaging. Republicans think sort of dollars and cents messaging will be enough. Let's steer away from the incendiary moral issues, anything that's incendiary, actually. Let's just stick to where the Chamber of Commerce is comfortable, talking about spending restraint and reducing tax burdens. And that's going to be sufficient to win the day, sufficient to advance the flag for free minds,
maybe,
and free markets.
Maybe in 1950, it might have.
Is it?
Because... Republicans, they run on facts. Democrats run on feelings, and feelings always win.
Yeah.
It's hard to argue.
There's certainly part of it. I mean, of course, part of it is, part of the fact is that Republicans slow walk some of the same policies the left fast walks.
Yes.
And so it dilutes their credibility on those issues.
Uh-huh.
Did we not learn a lesson from Trump? I mean, one of the great contributions Trump made, as far as I'm concerned, to the Republican Party was that he was always on offense, relentlessly so, even if you didn't like how he ran his offense every time. He was relentlessly on offense, and however hard you hit him with your feelings, he hits you back harder.
That's the playbook right there. I mean, I'm not kidding you.
I think it's an attitude adjustment. Again, it doesn't mean you have to have the same personality, make the same choices, but you have to have the same attitude or you're lost, aren't you?
Right, 100%. And that's the thing that won him the election was he punched back. That's all. And you know what? A lot of Republicans, myself included, just like to see somebody fight back because we just get run over all the time. And I think that that's the playbook. I mean, you're right. It doesn't always have to be on Twitter, and some of them were ridiculous, and sometimes he was his own worst enemy. But fight back, you know, and I think DeSantis does a little of that.
He does, and he does it in a way that's sort of more room temperature, more polished, which is why I think he is and should be the front runner for president in 24 if he wins re-election in Florida. Let's get past the gubernatorial re-election next year, too. You know, take nothing for granted. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Whether in an Illinois context or a federal one, are you content with the messaging you're getting from center-right candidates, conservatives like Gary Rabin? You heard him on these airwaves. Is that going to be enough? And remember, in a state like Illinois, where you have a deficit in terms of numbers with respect to R versus D, is that going to be enough to pull in disaffected Democrats as well?
I just Googled Gary's name real quick. And when he announced on Tuesday, the 30th of March, that he was going to run for governor, the headline in the Chicago Tribune, which I'm not a fan of, Schaumburg businessman Gary Rabin, supporter of Trump.
Yeah.
That's what they said.
Right. That's all he is. He's a supporter of Trump. And that's a piece written by a drunk and a hack.
So you saw it.
And a transactional journalist named Rick Pearson who's been writing those stories about Republicans for 30 years, and nobody seems to care.
Well, it's
and the conservatives, who know they're going to be treated unfairly by hacks, transactional, integrity-free reporters like Rick Pearson. They still play his game, and they play the game of the Chicago Press Corps. And that's another area where you need to be on offense. And in his announcement, Gary wasn't. I mean, again, he's a first-time candidate, so is Trump. And this is not to be critical of Gary. I think I expressed how much I like Gary. But you want somebody to do well that you like. And so we have to level with people what the landscape is, at least in our opinion. You can feel free to disagree. But as I said, tell me I'm wrong that the entire brand of the left is we're pro-equity and anti-hate. Those words don't mean anything anymore, but they give people that warm, sentimental, self-righteous feeling, and it's enough. The catastrophe at the border. Let me give you an example at the federal level. Feel free to weigh in at the federal level or the state level. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. AOC. The catastrophe at the border. Every day, the number of migrants expected to show up at the southern border increases by 0.5 to 2x.
Yeah, exponentially.
It was 800 grand that projected this year. Then yesterday it was 1 million. It was 100,000 in February. Now it's 150,000 illegal border crossings in March. 20,000 kids in federal custody in February. This is interesting. Half the nation disapproves of Biden's policies on immigration. According to a Marist NPR poll, 53% of respondents said they disapprove of Biden's work on immigration. 34% approve. 53-34. You would think the level of catastrophe, as we've talked about, it'd be bigger than a 19-point spread.
All right.
But it isn't. It's still the majority. And will Republicans, conservatives, will they unabashedly argue law and order, sensible approaches to border security, or will they be afraid to be called a racist?
That's it right there. Because the left says we are racist and we have too many rich people.
Listen to AOC talking about what the border crisis really is, because it's not really a national security crisis, you understand.
Are you for real? Well, let's talk about this, because so much of our national conversation, which is not a conversation, about immigration is driven by people who could not care less about immigrants. often people want to say, why aren't you talking about the border crisis? Or why aren't you talking about it in this way? Well, we're talking about it. They just don't like how we're talking about it. Because it's not a border crisis. It's an imperialism crisis. It's a climate crisis. It's a trade crisis. And also, it's a carceral crisis. Because as I have already said, even during this term and this president, our immigration system is based and designed on our carceral system.
She got a thesaurus for Christmas, a carceral system, incarceration.
No, it was casserole. It was a casserole.
Casserole system.
She was upset about the casserole situation.
It's an imperialism crisis. It's a climate crisis. It's a imprisonment crisis. That's what it really is at the border. Because we're an inhumane country, because we have concentration camps at the border, according to AOC, when Trump was president, because the border security folks are Nazis, according to AOC and her brethren. She's not losing. She may be losing temporarily the messaging with respect to the border, but she's not losing in terms of the constituency that they're putting together to maintain power in D.C. How can that be? I mean, if this is a competition, you have to look and say, well, somebody is playing the game by a different set of rules and they seem to be ahead.
They're playing on feelings. It's all feelings. Even the CDC is guilty of it now. You know, I'm going to go off script here and tell you my feeling is, you know,
Dr. Walensky,
we've got
as a mother, as a wife.
But exactly. That's okay. So I don't care about your feeling. I mean, you might also think the Knicks are going to be the NBA champs. I don't care either. That might be a feeling of yours too. But they play on those, and it wins. It does win. And unless you punch it back hard, they roll over. And that's the problem. And everybody's afraid to do anything or punch back because they're going to get called a racist. But don't worry about it anymore, people, because I'll tell you right now, just like impeachment, when the left gets a hold of those ideals, which we used to hold impeachment as a very serious thing, or to be called a racist was a really bad thing, they use those things so much, they cheapen them so much, they're so watered down now it doesn't matter anymore.
Well, it does. It is a tie that binds, though. It's a tie that binds the leftist activists, and they may not matter, and people may not believe what they're saying, but they're afraid to oppose.
Yeah, they are.
And if you're afraid to oppose, then you're provoking a continuation, and they will roll right over you, as we've seen.
Complicit, yeah.
Oprah, there's a show on the Oprah Network, OWN. I know you're a subscriber, Scott. it's a show
only
called,
because we could share trousers.
This is a show called Queen Sugar, and it's a series on the Oprah Network that follows the lives of contemporary women running a black-owned sugar farm in Louisiana who are also social justice activists. Get ready for that to be the plot line in everything. I'm doing this, and I'm also a social justice activist, and I'm also an anti-racist activist. Listen to this exchange just to give you a sense of how comprehensive their approaches. The branding is through all of the outlets, communication channels they control. And what's the pushback? What's the pushback? You know, outside of Salem radio stations and radio hosts, where's the pushback coming from?
Nowhere.
Just want to make sure everything is airtight for tomorrow. They're kids, you know, so I don't want any surprises.
We ain't got to worry about no foolishness out there. They babies.
Oh, I wish I could share your optimism. But in less than 4 years, Trump unleashed something from the shadows that took generations for our ancestors to drive out of the light in the first place.
Shh. We'll get rid of that fool come this November. Believe that.
I hope so. But I don't know. You see these people, it's a cult. They don't just believe him, they believe in him. A billionaire who's never worked a real day in his life, who dodged the military service, who don't believe in their churches, who scorns and derides them. They'd rather hang on to that nothingness, that disdain, rather than give up the dominance of whiteness.
Facts. No lie.
Even if he slithers away,
like the black unemployment rate,
everything he represents and promotes will never be gone. Not in our lifetimes, anyway. Maybe for Blue and his grandkids. You know, if we keep fighting, maybe.
And the response from most quarters is to defer.
Yep.
I don't subscribe to that vignette. I don't subscribe to AOC's lunacy, but I'm not going to say anything.
Okay.
I'm not going to do anything.
Here's my big parallel, Dan. I've never been more upset with the American electorate or just American business people when these governors shut down these restaurants, and there's way more restaurants than there are governors and or police to you know, look after the restaurant. Why didn't they in mass say, no, we're going to all open up? Because when it's only one person that steps out of line, the guy goes to jail. So if nobody says pushes back on this kind of stuff that you just heard, that person's going to get absolutely taken to the woodshed. But it has to be in mass, and nobody.
You know why?
Look what happened to Piers Morgan and Sharon Osbourne.
Yeah, but you know why? Because so many conservatives have it wrong. They think that this is about material comfort and protect material comfort at all costs. That the promise of America is an abundance of goods. You know who makes that promise? And that's the promise that politicians offer, both on the left and the right. You know who else offers that promise? The Chinese communists. You know who else offered that promise before them? The Soviet communists.
Yeah.
You understand? Why are conservatives slow walking so many down the same road to serfdom the left is sprinting? Because you're starting from the same point. You're starting from the same point. There is no fork in that road. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. You know, one of the things this country needs is some humor, too. You know, I mean, it's listening to that show that you had on there on the Oprah Network. I mean, everything is always so serious. So I guess maybe Trump at his next rally needs to dress up like Isaac from Children of the Corn. We're all a cult, you know. You got the cult of the blue man.
Yeah.
You know, get in one of those little, you know, reverend uniforms or, you know, get the reverend, I don't know what the word is. But,
yeah, you know, preacher. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
We need to be humorous, too. I mean, this is, you got to have some lightness.
A little levity, I agree.
Yeah, I agree. I just, you know, understand how humorless and unrelenting the left is. I mean, they're trying to eliminate comedy, so that's sort of a leading indicator. But yeah, maybe he can go out to Iowa and do a little parody at the Field of Dreams site or something. Bob in Edison Park.
Guys, I don't understand, and going back to the point you guys were just making, and I agree with it, I don't understand how these Republicans are not learning from Trump. All the issues that Trump was criticized on, from the mean tweets to the handling reporters, Trump won. Trump got more Republican votes, from what I understand, in a presidential election than any other Republican in history. Trump appealed to emotions, and Trump had passion. I think the big word is passion. These Republicans are passionless. From Ted Cruz on down, they go out there with this message, like you said, and it doesn't appeal. All I could speak for is me. I can't speak to statistics and numbers and big words and all these things. Trump appealed to my emotion and my passion. And if the Republicans don't tap on that, they're finished. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Bob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you like somebody that fights for you. I like somebody that fights back. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I say this as people listen to the show know, as somebody who was a major Trump skeptic when he first announced.
Yeah. And then you went to Walker, I think.
I was, you know, Walker, Cruz. I was Trump only
he
as
was
the
Trump as the last
as the nominee.
Resort.
I was. But I mean, you know, you have to call things as you see them. And that's what he did. It was a huge gift he gave, the example. And now you modify it to improve on it going forward, like DeSantis, I think, is doing in Florida. But you have other people that learn no lessons,
learn nothing
from Trump.
No.
Just want to forget it like the left does.
This is the world we live in, and it confounds me daily. But listening to that clip that we just played, he had the black unemployment rate the lowest in the last 40 or 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
That means nothing to them.
Well, it drove
this from the light. Yeah, drove people into jobs.
Yeah, but that's part of it, and the other part of it is don't defer. I'm not going to let you get away with playing that game on me.
No kidding.
No way. No way are you going to play that race hustle, you're a victim game. Bull jive. I'm calling you on it everywhere. I don't care. I am not deferring to anybody based on their race or their gender or any other identity characteristic. Defer to no one. We're going to have a conversation on the merits. You're not, you can name call all you want, and I'm going to stick right here. And I'm going to, you know, hold forth, and we'll go back and forth, just like we did outside that Elmhurst cleaner over the weekend. The hell with that. The hell with you thinking you're just going to roll over people. No way. Who's doing that? The Republican Party?
No.
No. Bill in Itasca.
Hey, guys, first of all, you know, thanks so much for bringing this up. And, you know, I don't know. I don't think I have anything new to add to the conversation. But I've been screaming at the radio and the TV for the last 2-3 years about the lack of offense on the Republican Party. It drives me absolutely crazy. You turn on Fox and, you know, all they sit there and do is complain about the latest offensive move by the Democratic Party. And it's a whole thought shift that has to happen with the Republicans, even with your conversation with Rabine. It's a lot of what he's talking about is rinse and repeat, like yes. You say, Dan. And I'm sure he's probably a good guy and all. I'm sure he is. He's coming from the right place, but he's not going to get anywhere if he doesn't completely change the tone instead of constantly reacting to these people in a defensive position. You've got to go after them. Offensively, just keep going after them, not just on one front, but on multiple fronts, because that's what they do to the Conservative Party.
Thanks.
Anyway,
thanks for the call, Bill. Appreciate it. Yeah, you know, look, 7 states are suing over critical race theory in there, or moving legislation, I should say, moving legislation over to ban critical race theory, demagoguery, propaganda, agitprop as part of their K-12 curriculum. Is Illinois one of them? No. Has any Republican suggested that? No. 30 states are moving legislation to have girls play girls sports and boys play boys sports.
That's a novel idea, by the way.
Is Illinois one of them? No. Is any Republican saying anything about it? No. What the hell's wrong with people? And you, $420 billion in unfunded. Yeah, look, I talked all that green eyeshade stuff for the last 20 years, too. You know, the people who care are already in the camp.
Right.
And it's a small camp,
so
not a lot of people.
So for the article that the Chicago Tribune put out about him running as a Trump supporter, he should have called up and said exactly what you said about Dan Pearson. You know, here's the headline.
Rick Pearson.
Here's the headline.
He should have said when he's like, "What do you think about Trump's claim that the election was rigged?" Hey, Rick, leave.
Right.
Get out of here. This is a candidacy for adults in an adult time. Get out of here. You're not welcome at my press conference. So we're going to talk about things that matter to this state. And we're going to put in the fight for people who play by the rules in this state and who have been hornswoggled by the political class. And oh, by the way, Rick, that includes you and your outlet.
100%.
And if you want to take it outside, I'll follow you right outside. Honestly, that's where it should be, in my opinion. Dan and in for Amy J this morning is Scott S. Scott Chalet, the cow guy.
Good morning.
NBC's Lester Holt, Chicago's very own. Chicago for time before he blew up. We've done so much. Lester Holt, Don Lemon. You're welcome, America.
Yeah.
He recently was awarded the Edward R. Murrow Award. Mm-hmm. And he took the occasion of that honor to offer this.
The unprecedented attacks on the press in this period, I'm sure, will fill plenty of books and be studied in classrooms, maybe even here. But I have a few early observations I'll share about where this moment brings us and what we can learn. Number one is, I think it's become clearer that fairness is overrated. Well, before you run off and tweet that headline, let me explain a bit. The idea that we should always give two sides equal weight and merit does not reflect the world we find ourselves in. That the sun sets in the west is a fact. Any contrary view does not deserve our time or attention. I know recent events assure that you won't have to look far to find more current and relevant examples. I think you get my point. Decisions to not give unsupported arguments equal time are not a dereliction of journalistic responsibility or some kind of agenda. In fact, it's just the opposite. Providing an open platform for misinformation, for anyone to come say whatever they want, especially when issues of public health and safety are at stake, can be quite dangerous. Our duty is to be fair to the truth. Holding those in power accountable is at the core of our function and responsibility. We need to hear our leaders' views, their policies, and reasoning. It's really important, but we have to stand ready to push back and call out falsehoods.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That seems innocuous enough, doesn't it? Is it innocuous? Well, I mean, I agree with him in theory, but how does that actually operate in practice with the D.C. press corps, Lester Holt and his friends?
Exactly. Coming from his place, it's blasphemous. I mean, yes, I agree in theory, but you know where they're coming from, and so it ruins everything.
It's a high-minded way to bootstrap a justification for their marginalization of people who disagree with them.
Right. And so here's the
the merits.
Right.
Who have arguments, who have data and science if you want to talk about COVID, or who have economic substantiation if you want to talk about tax and spend policies. But in the in interest of fairness to the truth, we're going to stilt our coverage to advance our position and those who hold our position. Isn't that what actually happens in practice?
Okay, yes. And here's what they've done. They've conveniently manipulated Americans into believing there are two truths, right? Because you argue with them and they say, well, that's my truth. It doesn't matter. This is my truth. And I would argue back, no, unfortunately, whomever I'm speaking to, there is only one truth. You can't have your truth and I can't have my truth. We can have a truth, the one truth. Mm-hmm. But they've convinced you that you can have your truth, mm-hmm. which is absolutely wrong.
When Nancy Pelosi says that transfer payments are stimulative, they're growth-oriented, is there pushback on that? Do you get an economist on to say, well, that's actually not true. Taking from one arm, putting into another arm is not growth. is not growth-oriented. For example, is it truth when AOC says that we don't have a border crisis, we have a climate crisis that's manifesting itself on the border? Is that the proximate cause for the 150,000 people expected to cross the border illegally in March, according to the Biden administration? Is that the proximate cause? Is there pushback there? Is there fairness to the truth when those pronouncements are made?
Of course not.
Is there fairness to the truth when news outlets, Eastern Seaboard news outlets, the Amazon Post, the Gray Lady, use anonymous sources as a thinly veiled cover to make unsubstantiated claims against political opponents, against people they disagree with politically? Is that fairness to the truth less?
Yeah. I mean, I get frustrated because in my business, you know, there are things that are tried and true. Don't fight the Fed, you know, things like that. We all kind of adhere to. But when we have the problem, the surge, the crisis on the border that we have, and it's one, you can't put the blame or the truth anywhere else except for the fact that a man said, come to this country, rush our borders. He said that. So what? That is the truth, right? You can't argue anything else except for what came out of somebody's mouth, and this is the problem that manifested from that.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Professor Mark Berline, professor of English at Emory University, senior editor at First Things, author of The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Mark, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, I have to say, that opening quotation, I mean, which is worse? The flat-out bogus claim that the media makes for themselves, or the ego that allows one to state it in such solemn and self-congratulatory terms? It's extraordinary. And if the press holds to such high ideals, if it has such noble standards, then why is public approval of the press so doggone low.
Well, you heard.
Why does everyone despise you?
You heard Lester Holt say at the opening, you know, you've got to don the cloak of the victim first. So there'll be books written for years about the attacks on the press over the recent past. He's talking about Trump, obviously. And then, but here's the standard we hew to, despite the fact that we're under siege. They're so heroic, as you say.
And the claim of fact and science, I mean, the liberal claim that science is on their side, let's be clear. All the science that deals with race issues, sexuality issues, family formation, education, the education of the young, all of that falls heavily on the side of an anti-liberal viewpoint. When it comes to all those social issues and private and family issues and educational issues in the schools, then the liberals have bought into a series of leftist myths. You guys are all wrong on the science. We need to reiterate. We need to throw this right back in their faces.
And I wonder how Les would react to Thomas Frank's recent piece, for which he is under assault from the left. Liberals want to blame right-wing misinformation, quote-unquote, for our problems. Get real. Thomas Frank, the celebrated author of What's the Matter with Kansas from about, 15, 16 years ago, a man of the left. And he writes lamentably about the illiberalism of the liberal in America today, particularly with the First Amendment. He writes of their pro-censorship position. What all the censorship talk really is, though, is a declaration of defeat. Defeat before the Biden administration has really begun. To give up on free speech is to despair of reason itself. The people simply cannot be persuaded. Something more forceful is in order. They must be guided by we, the enlightened, and the first step in such a program as to shut off America's many, many burbling fountains of bad takes. Critical of his fellow travelers on the left, Thomas Frank.
You know, something really terrible has happened to liberalism. And I don't mean the ideas. I mean the kind of spine that liberals used to have in the old days. I wrote a column about this the other day. Thomas Frank shows a little backbone here and stands up for the First Amendment. The First Amendment was the core of liberalism, and it was squarely opposed to leftist forms of indoctrination, censure, control, totalitarianism. I mean, backbone liberals like JFK, like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the very few today, like Thomas Frank. Why are liberals now so mushy about these? Why do they allow the left to push them around? Why do they get down on their hands and knees and apologize for the institutions that they run, for the systemic racism, for crimes that were committed 200 years ago? It is embarrassing to see liberals turn into such wet noodles and easily intimidated by these outlandish leftist figures like Stacey Abrams. I think that, I mean, what has happened to liberal confidence? But what has happened to the liberal principle? They just go with the wind. They bend with the times. And the left loves them for it, and it's even more intimidating.
But with respect to what you're describing, it's a little bit more than embarrassing, isn't it? I mean, in terms of the threat it presents to a free people, a free-thinking free people. I mean, we've had periods of this sort of expression of conduct, and they are not periods we reflect upon positively in America.
It's almost as if they deny the reality of leftist goals. It's almost they think that, well, leftists, they just get a little extreme sometimes. Yes, they go a little bit overboard, but they have good intentions and they want to create a better world. Some of them actually are naive enough to believe that leftists are altruistic, benign figures with just some occasional improper methods. They refuse to look in the eyes of these people and see merciless totalitarians ready to take charge and they are going to expel all dissent. Whatever happened to the liberal that said we have to preserve a degree of critical dissent in any healthy society? Gone. Gone.
It's like there's an unwritten book of rules, and they keep changing them. And that's what it feels like to me, that they're going to keep moving the goalposts until you succumb. You know, it's 15 days,
right?
30 days to fight the cure, or until the cure, whatever, flatten the curve,
This is one of the tactics of political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
You're never quite sure of what counts. I mean, what was last year okay? Well, now suddenly this year is not okay. Cultural celebration before is now cultural appropriation.
Right.
So keeping you uncertain, keeping you always looking over your shoulder, keeping people nervous, this is one of the formulas of a revolutionary.
So we have the boycotts being called for the state of Georgia from the sports world, effectively from the corporate world, and the academy. Mm-hmm. Based because of the election reform legislation, of course. And the Academy, just an example, and I will get your take on the Academy since you're part of it. This is from the president of my alma mater, Morton Shapiro at Northwestern. Update on commitments to social justice. We are envisioning a new model for campus safety. We're working to adapt more inclusive hiring practice. And by continuing to listen to the many voices on our campuses, we're seeking to steward racial equity in all places in which we learn, work, and live. There's a section on reopening the Black House, racial equity in Chicago and Evanston, anti-racism and social justice training. It just goes on interminably. Diverse candidate slates, implementing community safety proposals, which is downscoping campus police, because that's an institution of institutional racism, and so on and so forth as well. And it just goes on and on and on. All identity to politics all the time. For $65,000 a year.
Very important to keep in mind the relationship between the condition of the media today and the condition of academia, because the younger journalists are the worst. They are the ones who do not respect the old professional norms. They don't believe in old ideas of neutrality and objectivity and fairness. Fairness isn't giving everyone an equal say. Fairness is treating everyone equally and giving them the chance to speak their piece. It is not a matter of everything's equal. That is a leftist notion of fairness, which is what we heard at the beginning. Now, the younger journalists pass through academia after the humanities collapsed.
Right.
After ideas of truth and tradition and heroism and great book civilization, after that was gone. Academia is largely to blame for these D.C. journalists.
100%.
They're not well-read. They're not educated people. They think very highly of themselves. But these are not informed individuals. Now, about these proposals in academia about equity and racial justice, this isn't going to work because these programs don't make people happy. They're no fun. You can't tell any joke in these kinds of spheres.
Yeah, well.
Everyone is nervous and uncomfortable. You're making people miserable. Does anybody think college campuses are fun places anymore?
Mm. That's a great point, though. It's one I make all the time about journalism students and college students generally, and people in the media generally, which is the point that Thomas Sowell made in Inside American Higher Education like 30 years ago, which is we have a nation of young people with very high self-esteem about how little they know. That's a bad recipe. Mark Bauerlein is a professor of English at Emory University, senior editor of First Things, author of the book The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Professor Bauerlein, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you join us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. this morning, Scott the Cow Guy, Shalady.
Good morning, all morning.
Good morning. Glad to have you as again, as always, Scott. Big Fox Business star.
I always wonder how many people said no before you got to me on the phone tree.
It was less than a dozen. Chicago's Lincoln Park, Old Town, Gold Coast neighborhoods. See dangerous spike in COVID cases. Health officials say the spike in new cases is being driven by people aged 19 to 39. Oh, you mean the invulnerable?
Right.
Alderman Michelle Smith, 43rd Ward, you know, this area, these neighborhoods. Very disappointed in those numbers.
Oh, okay.
We need...
how many people? Did they have a number?
We need to do a better job. Yeah, they have numbers. I mean,
because I look at those as just new vaccinations.
Not 19-year-olds?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
That's a new vaccination to me. Anybody under the age of 30 that gets COVID, I'm like, thank you for the vaccination. Now you've got your antibodies. Let's move on. That adds to the herd immunity.
Michelle Smith had a different take, as the lockdowners are wont to have. If these numbers of cases don't get under control, it could cause another shutdown. was pointed out to us on this show earlier in the week by Johns Hopkins doctor, Marty Makary, we're at the point now where we're tracking for herd immunity by the end of next month. And he essentially said, look, there's no chance for another surge because there's not enough individuals. Now, you could see cases go up and then come back down and so on and so forth. But another surge like we had intermittently over the last 12 months, it's not possible because the combination of those who've recovered from the infection and those who've been vaccinated precludes such a surge.
Right.
Not to mention the fact you'll have so many people in that 19 to 39 cohort that's a dangerous spike in Chicago who don't even know they have it.
Which, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of science on that, too. I mean, look, Japan's got, you know, 98% of the people in Japan wear masks. Their cases are rising. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is
France,
all...
France locked down for the third time. I mean, it's you can't get out. When you set these metrics and you engage in the sort of science-free fear-mongering, how do you get out? This is what, again, Swedish state epidemiologist Johan Giesecke, former state epidemiologist, said at the outset of this with the lockdowns as the response, I don't know how you get out once you get in, once you set the standard, set the precedent that this is how we're going to respond. We're going to lock down healthy people.
It's absolutely the wrong thing to do, 100%. It's what lazy legislatures do.
And by the way, good piece by Richard Schwartz at City Journal. It shows reckless disregard for the future of your city, too. When you're talking about cities like Chicago, New York,
we don't have a future.
Lorded over by lockdowners. Schwartz notes, COVID-19 has made people wonder how much physical interaction is needed in a world defined by social distancing and elbow bumps. Why operate your business from an expensive midtown office when all you need is a smartphone or laptop, a tasteful backdrop for your video calls and Amazon Prime? Ask the same question on a societal level, and one begins to wonder why it's necessary to pour billions into a staggeringly expensive system of urban infrastructure, Joe Biden, when all you need to keep the wheels of commerce turning is Zoom, Signal, and a reliable, super-fast wireless network. That's what's happening. And, you know, we're...
And they're doing it to themselves, though.
And we're not even near the reckoning with things like commercial real estate.
No. And all the small businesses in those big buildings down in the city, I mean, it's a joke. We haven't begun to count those COVID deaths of those businesses.
But New York is forging ahead with the Excelsior. Drive it right off the showroom floor, their vaccine passport. And that sets up our conversation with our next guest. She is Janine Yunes, who is joining us again. We've spoken with her before. She's a public defender at the appellate court level, I believe, in New York City. And contributed a couple of columns recently to the American Institute for Economic Research, a couple of good columns on this topic of vaccine passports and lockdowns. Janine, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
So are you excited about the rollout of the Excelsior?
No, I am not. I would say the opposite. I think this is an extremely dangerous road to go down. we are creating two classes of people now and making people feel coerced into getting a vaccine, which I think is a very dangerous route to take.
Well, you know, part of the thing, too, I would think if you're a business owner, I mean, I'm telling you, like, just me personally, and I don't think I may not be the majority, but I think I represent a significant cohort of people in Chicago. I'm not going to see the White Sox and wear a mask for nine innings. I want to see the new Bob Odenkirk movie, normal, but I'm not going to sit through it with a mask on at the theater. And I think a lot of people are like that too. So fine, you know, you're just as Richard Schwartz writes, it's fine. I got Amazon Prime. I'll wait for it to get to Prime. I've got all the other tools of technology that I need. I just won't participate in and patronize those places I used to.
Right. Right.
I mean, is that what you see? I mean, is that part of the conversation in New York as well?
So most people are willing to wear a mask in New York. I hear very few complaints about that except for myself.
Right.
And very few people actually have a problem with the vaccine passport idea, which is stunning to me. And the other thing about it is that it denies natural immunity. A lot of New Yorkers had COVID, but you can't, that's not enough. You have to have had the vaccine.
Yeah,
and
I had it. I mean, I'm not getting the vaccine.
Yeah. And then you get the vaccine and you've got to wear two masks.
Right.
Exactly.
I'm in that.
I mean, I had,
Well, I'm in that camp that, you know, going to the baseball game, I'm just going to go and not wear a mask and see what happens. That's what I'm going to do. I don't care. I mean,
I've been doing that in New York, actually.
There you go. Good for you.
Just don't wear a mask and see how long I can get away with it.
it's sort of an interesting, give us a take on how that's been received because, you know, Chicago, like New York, has a very docile population, as you were describing.
Yeah, well, so I try to do it on the subway. That's like my...
Well, you're the only one on the subway, so that doesn't count.
Here's your personal train.
Yeah. I'm actually usually not the only person on, and so far no one said anything to me. I've done it about 10 times.
I mean, what is the, you know, we've talked to people, you know, sort of financial services in New York over the many months, giving us a handle on what's happening on the ground there. I mean, what's your take on the future of that city, what you used to enjoy and where you think that enjoyment will go?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's the city is actually, it's sort of coming to life with the warm weather a little bit. But as far as, you know, theater and all sorts of things that we used to appreciate in tourism, I have no idea. I don't see it coming back anytime soon.
I feel like you do too, Janine. I think it's a false dawn, though, because you listen to the CEOs and you look at the numbers and you see these polls. Only 22% of CEOs say that they're going to tell their folks to come back to work after the vaccine takes hold and we've got herd immunity. 56% have basically said, I don't care where you work. So we're not going to, I mean, those are customers that the cities need that aren't going to be coming in. Those are customers for the trains that they get on coming in. I mean, I think, you know, we're not getting back to a normal. We'll have a new normal, but it's going to be fundamentally different.
Oh, for sure. So my office is in the financial district of New York, and, you know, it used to be like bustling, and there are all sorts of coffee shops and lunch places. They're all closed, probably permanently. The only things that are open are, you know, tend to be the big chains like McDonald's, Starbucks, and it's so quiet. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, the good news is you're not having to run into those Wolf of Wall Street guys anymore. You know, you know, you're a public defender. So let's talk about this in terms of, like, you know, people that will be sanctioned legally, perhaps, for not having their papers, and how you see this playing out, just as, you know, sort of the fines and other punishments for not abiding the mask mandates as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is going to, as it always is, it's going to be the poor who suffer the most. I mean, they have the least access to vaccines. Ironically, also, it's like the poor and working class who had more COVID because they were going to work the whole time. It was the Zoom class that was protected. So, you know, a lot of them have natural immunity, but probably aren't going to get the vaccine. And so you're really going to create another sort of divide between the classes, in my opinion. And it's really a terrible thing what's happening to the city.
One of the other divides that you wrote about is the divide in terms of like how healthy people are during these lockdowns. I mean, you know, some people have the Peloton at home and so forth, but other people don't. And if they've also been pushed out of their job temporarily and just are waiting for the latest round of checks from the government. I mean, I've referenced this piece that you you co-authored with Kylie Holiday. Those numbers about the weight gain for the significant portion of the population that gained weight during the pandemic are astounding in terms of the impact on health and I, of course, ironically, on their exposure to COVID.
Right. I mean, it's so ironic because we're creating more people who are susceptible to a severe outcome now. We know that being overweight is one of the number one risk factors apart from age. And now more people are unhealthy. And it's not just, you know, moving around less because you're not going to work. It's also, you know, isolation and being deprived of all of the things that sort of make us happy, social contact, etc. People are snacking more. They're depressed. And so we're worsening the problem in the long run. This is not what we've done does not take the long view into account at all.
And then not to mention, as we know, I mean, we've said it ad nauseum on the show, but it bears continuous repeating, which is the screenings and the other health care that you should be getting that you're not getting or that you're in queue to get. And this, again, disproportionately impacts the lower income person and lower income family in New York, just like in any big city.
Exactly. I mean, the whole idea of lockdowns is ridiculous. I mean, it's premised on this false idea that you can sort of put people apart like rats in cages and so we can eradicate this virus or bring the numbers down a lot. That's not how it works. You know, the essential workers are still going to work. They're cooking your takeout. They're, you know, delivering it to you, et cetera. People in grocery stores are still working. And a lot of people who are poor actually live in very crowded conditions. They're home more now because there's less to do because everything's locked down. So they're actually spreading it more amongst themselves. All it's really doing is just protecting the Zoom class who, you know, frankly, doesn't necessarily need protecting unless you're, you know, older and poor health.
Yeah, and then when they do go outside, they lecture you about science and data. That's always enjoyable. Janine Yunez, public defender, New York City. Check out her pieces, which I'll tweet out. Your right to refuse a health passport and lockdowns worsen the health crisis. Janine, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
She joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Scott, the guy, guy, Shalady, in for Amy. And Scott, I still haven't gotten over the passing of Alex Trebek. Now we could be losing Pat Sajak. I mean, not to death, but to the purge. Pat Sajak in trouble, or at least they're trying to create trouble for him for this exchange with a guest named Chris Brimble in a February show that was taped in February.
California tech sales, huh?
Yeah, I work for a technology company. We sell technology that benefits older adults living in senior living communities.
Yeah, that's a tough thing, too, because technology and sometimes people are not open to new ideas.
You'd be surprised how open they are.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Well, I'm glad. So that's just a myth.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
I see.
You get that I see at the end, sort of making fun of his lisp.
Is he really
bit.
Even making fun of the lisp? Or, you know?
I think he did a little bit, but, you know, so it's a little bit like... I don't know.
The humorous left again. I don't know.
I mean, I get it. You know, you don't make fun of somebody.
It's mildly inappropriate.
Yeah.
But is it career ending?
Well, if you gauge what is a mortal sin based on Twitter, you know, they're just looking for something like this to go into full moral panic. And that's what you got. Pat Sajak is now sort of like, you know, the enemy of the speech impediment community.
I used to be a fan. I grew up with a, you know, I'm not a fan anymore. I'm you know,
Pat Sajak.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I haven't heard from the contestant if, like, you know, if he just started, took it in stride. I mean, You know, can you bust people's chops anymore?
I mean, yeah. I mean,
you know, it's all friendly. It's a freaking game show. I mean, it, like, you humiliate him or anything. Again, it's like, as you said, mildly inappropriate. Okay, you know, tone deaf, but is it a career ender?
I don't know. I mean, look, the play-by-play guy for the Sacramento Kings got fired for saying all lives matter. So I guess anything can end your career nowadays.
Yeah. Well, all right. We'll be on Pat Sajak's career death watch for the foreseeable future.
Be very careful yourself, Dan.
Yeah,
that's all it is.
Yeah, we'll let you know. Coming up at 8:38, we're going to talk to Jack Phillips. Jack Phillips, Masterpiece Cake Shop. The Christian baker who has spent, unfortunately, more time in courts of law in the last few years than in baking cakes because of that same purging left. But now we check the headlines with Mike Scott.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now. And make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan. And in framing it this morning is Scott the Cow Guy Shalady, Fox Business Superstar.
Good morning. Yeah.
Margaret Harper McCarthy has a good piece in the Wall Street Journal about the Equality Act. Remember that? That's also pending. H.R. 1, federalizing elections, $2 trillion in funny money that Biden announced yesterday. I understand all these things are running concurrently, but don't forget about the Equality Act and the denial of reality. Very good op-ed. She cites Chesterton from 100 years ago. Everything will be denied. Everything will become a creed. It is a reasonable position to deny the stones in the street. It will be religious dogma to assert them. Fires will be kindled to testify that 2 and 2 make 4. Swords will be drawn to prove that leaves are green in summer. We shall be left defending not only the incredible virtues and sanities of human life, but something more incredible still, this huge, impossible universe which stares us in the face. The Equality Act, and by extension, the Marxist left, at war with reality. And aren't they? As she writes, the Equality Act doesn't concern such invisible mysteries as the Holy Trinity. That is a matter of belief in the strict sense. The Equality Act concerns things everyone can see and understand. Infants don't need instruction to know that their mothers are the ones who are nursing them, and their fathers are the ones who are not. Sexual difference is obvious to anyone with eyes to see. But you have to understand the perspective of the Marxist revolutionary. Relations signified by sexual bodies not good because they are given, not chosen. And autonomy is the ultimate good, so long as it doesn't run afoul of the diktats of the state, of course, or the vanguard class in control of the state. But I digress. And so they must be this, what is given, must be the ultimate target of resistance. Scholars of revolutionary history have noted this, and modern ideology, as Hannah Arendt suggested, the banality of evil, that Hannah Arendt, is characterized by the knowledgeable dismissal of the visible. It's purposeful to a particular end. That's what we see playing out. And so who will fight for what is? Well, one is a philosophy professor. Did you see this case? Nicholas Merriweather taught philosophy for years at Shawnee State University, public school, 3,500 students in Ohio. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, in an opinion by Judge Amul Thapar, Trump appointee, the importance of federal judicial appointments, right here. Mr. Merriweather's pedagogical method is to hold Socratic discussions while addressing students as Mr. or Miss to create an atmosphere of seriousness. After class in early 2018, a student whom Mr. Merriweather had called Sir approached and requested to be addressed with feminine pronouns. The professor said he wasn't sure he could comply because his sincerely held religious beliefs prevented him from communicating messages about gender identity he believes are false. The student got hostile, saying, I guess this means I can call you a blank, and promised that Merriweather would be fired. Well, university's Title IX office said Merriweather's refusal was the proximate cause of the hostile environment, not the student's response. But overturning an earlier dismissal, the Sixth Circuit revived Merriweather's legal claims under the Constitution's guarantee of free speech and religious exercise, even though he's a school employee. The First Amendment protects the academic speech of university professors, wrote Judge Thapar. Also, pronouns can and do convey a powerful message implicating a sensitive topic of public concern. So we'll see where that goes. But there's somebody who is going to stand up for what
is.
Fight
back, right.
And somebody who's been doing the same for some time now is Jack Phillips. He is the owner, proprietor of Masterpiece Cake Shop in Colorado. And we've had him on the show before. And you say, well, wait a second, Dan, why is he back? He won that case. He took that case all the way to the Supreme Court. You know, he wouldn't make a custom wedding cake for a same-sex couple because it was violative of his religious beliefs, his Christian beliefs, in terms of participating in such a ceremony. He was happy to serve the couple in some other capacity, happy to make a cake for them for a non-religious event, but he couldn't make it for that specific event, and of course that was their purpose. That was in 2012. In 2018, he was partially victorious before the Supreme Court, only partially. The Supreme Court didn't issue a holding, as I said at the time, comprehensive enough that he wouldn't face the next identitarian trying to jackpot him, which is an indication of a good faith neighbor, a fair-minded person, or something else, I would ask. He's back in court facing a lawsuit from a transgender lawyer. Oh, but he wasn't targeted, right?
That's convenient.
Autumn Scardina, who attempted to order a birthday cake from Masterpiece Cake Shop that was blue on the outside, pink on the inside in honor of her gender transition. The request, note the timing, came on the same day in 2017 that the Supreme Court announced it would hear Phillips's appeal in the wedding cake case. For more on this case and the continued persecution by the identitarian left of one Jack Phillips, we're pleased to be joined by Jack Phillips, owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop, as well as his attorney, Jonathan Scruggs, from the Alliance Defending Freedom. Make sure I don't get him into any more legal travails. Jack, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
So, you know, I know you're interested in making baked goods, not in accessing every court of law that's available in this country, but that's in part what you've been doing for the last almost a decade now. And I just wonder, first, before we get into the particulars, you know, just how you're holding up. What's your attitude towards this?
Oh, we're holding up really well. We've got, you know, God's provided everything we need, and especially the incredible counsel from Alliance Defending Freedom. Their help all the way through this has been amazing. But, yeah, we're doing really well.
So this attorney, this trans attorney that's now suing you, I don't know which way this is going, but I guess Autumn, it's a he to a she.
Careful, you might get sued.
Well, I mean, this attorney named Autumn that's suing you. How about that? This is confusing times. How do you react? I mean, this person is obviously trying to jackpot you, obviously was targeting you. And you seem to just sort of take this targeting and this hate that is directed at you, and that's what it is for all, you know, all the conversation about anti-hate, and of course it's a cover story for their projection. But you seem to just sort of take it in stride and say, well, this is just, you know, the cross I have to bear.
Yeah, well, like you were saying, this started way back in 2012 with the cake for the same-sex wedding. But actually, within 2 weeks of that encounter with those two men, I received a couple of emails already from this attorney and calling me a hypocrite in one, a bigot in another, and then later on calling and asking for a red and black cake depicting Satan smoking a joint. And these are all, I didn't know who it was at the time. These are all cakes that I would decline to create for anybody. The same-sex wedding cake I wouldn't make in any situation, or a cake celebrating a gender transition. So it's not the person asking for the cake, it's the cake itself, you know. Doesn't matter who it was. And this attorney has said that this was a cake request designed to correct the errors of my thinking. And so it's clearly an attack and a targeted attack at that.
So I guess you're not going to pick up a pair of those little Nasdaq Satan shoes then to wear at the shop. So where does the case stand here with attorney Autumn?
We were in court last week. We had a trial in Colorado court. and it was done remotely, but we had the examination, cross-examination, all those things, and then the final arguments were on Wednesday, and the judge will evaluate everything, and we'll get a decision here in the next few weeks. But just sitting through that trial, and my wife had to be on the witness stand, and my daughter, as well as myself, and watch the opposing attorneys, you know, examine, cross-examine, and grill, and try and trick and trap, and you just have to sit there with your hands folded and let somebody, you know, badger your wife and your daughter, trying to get them to say something that would be incriminating all the time. All we're trying to do is say, you know, we will serve this person in any other capacity, like you were saying with the same-sex wedding. We'll do other custom work. You're welcome to anything in the store, any of the services that we provide for anybody. But there's just some cakes with messages that we can't create, and this was one of them.
You know, and thanks, Jack. You know, what town of Colorado are you in?
We're in Lakewood, which is a suburb of Denver.
Yeah, I know. And I used to be a bench warmer for the University of Colorado football team, so I'm pretty familiar with it.
Yeah, we're on the west side of Denver, right up
so
against.
I'm going to assume, I know Lakewood, that there are other bakers and cake shops in Lakewood, correct?
You've probably visited them all.
I look like I have.
Yeah, there's actually another really nice cake shop right across the street from us, you know, like a 30-second walk.
So, you know, clearly, I'll say it, maybe you won't, but they're just trying to cause trouble, really. I mean, look, if I went in someplace and they didn't want to serve me because, you know, their beliefs, I go, all right, whatever, and go to the next shop. What, you know, it's like not worth my time. I guess they're trying to make a point, and maybe I'll catch some grief for saying it this way, but it just, obviously, Dan's right. You know, they're just trying to pick a fight. The second one's trying to pick a fight. Maybe the first one wasn't, but still, they could have gotten the cake made elsewhere, I'm sure.
And then in part of the mediation, though, at a face-to-face meeting with this attorney, and toward the end of that conversation, this attorney told me that if I won this case or if it was dismissed for any reason, a technicality or whatever, that I would get a phone call the next day with a new cake and start this case all over again. Mm-hmm. So, and I asked this attorney, did you just say this? Yes, I did. So this is, you know, clearly a targeted act. And if the judge rules in our favor, then we would appeal to they would appeal probably to the Court of Appeals. If the judge rules against us, then we'll appeal. But either way, I think this attorney will be back with another cake.
Well, yeah, Autumn said, right? Yeah, correct your thinking. I mean, that's pretty clear. And, you know, frankly, unfortunately, a case like this, I guess, needs to go back to the high court so that they can offer a more comprehensive statement, ideally, on freedom of religion, particularly against the Equality Act, when you have people like Dick Durbin comparing Christian beliefs to Christian beliefs about something like this, or, for example, women in sports. Durbin, you saying that essentially religion is used as a weapon by the discriminator, and he compared the use of religion or the invocation of religion with respect to matters like this to the invocation of religion to defend lynchings. I mean, this is sort of the climate here, and it is pretty despicable, and it's pretty hyperbolic. But it's got to be no fun to be in the crucible where you are. And I just wonder what the community that you serve otherwise, how they have responded to the suits against you, the position you've taken, and the treatment that you're getting.
The community has been just tremendously supportive. You know, we've gotten phone calls, emails, you know, cards, and personal visits, people that will come in and actually pray for us, and they understand, you know, how important this is. I even have a customer who identified himself first time we met a few years ago as a gay man, and he testified for us in our trial last week because that it's just always the cake that is an issue, the message of the cake. It's never the person. And he's even written an editorial in our favor for the Colorado Springs Gazette a couple of years ago. You know, pointing out also that there are other cakes that I don't do. A lot of people think it's just a same-sex wedding or I'm against transgender, but I also don't create cakes that would celebrate Halloween or that would be anti-American or cakes that would disparage other people, including people who identify as LGBT. I've been asked to create cakes, you know, with, you know, God hates, you know, homosexuals, using the other expletive.
Right.
And I decline that as well because it's the cake itself. It's not the person who's ordering
right.
it.
Yeah, and God doesn't hate, so you're not going to participate in that. That's pretty straightforward. You know, it's interesting too. You know, as I followed your legal travails, I haven't heard a lot of members of the clergy speak up, and maybe I've missed it. And I wonder locally or nationally. I mean, I've seen op eds defending you and National Review and some of the conservative outlets, the First Things, and some of the religious oriented outlets. But members of the clergy rally to your defense to say this is persecuting somebody for their legitimate Christian beliefs. This is a man living his faith in an honorable way, and he's being persecuted, and this is not right.
There have been members of the clergy that have sided with us, and in some ways, I'm glad that it hasn't been like overwhelmingly like a Baptist or a Lutheran or whatever, because then it's Jack Phillips. With this denomination, but essentially it's Jack Phillips, you know, a citizen, just a small business owner. And this is a really small business owner. We went from 10 people the day before David and Charlie came in asking for their wedding cake down to 4, including me. And now we have 2 full-time people, including my daughter, myself, and a couple of part-timers. So it's been difficult that way. And I'm glad that we're, you know, portrayed then as, you know, just the individual
just
citizen
reasonable people exercising their constitutional rights like any other American. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Right.
But that is an important though. So your business has suffered as a result of all this.
Yeah, the first decision caused us to stop creating wedding cakes, which was a huge part of our business at that time. And while we're still in court, we're not doing that. So we've never gotten that business back.
A message, I mean, your example is sort of the message, but I just wonder, you know, we're on this show, we try to encourage people to stand up for themselves and be courageous in the face of unreason and the unkindness that follows, to borrow from Chesterton again. And, and I wonder if you have a message for those people who are afraid to speak up against unreason and unkindness.
Yeah. Again, like I said, this is a very small company, and it could happen here. It could happen to anybody. And so I'd advise people, we already knew at the beginning, before we opened our shop almost 30 years ago, we had made guidelines of what cakes we would create, what cakes we wouldn't create, and new ones come up. But we knew what lines in the sand, so to speak, that we would not cross. And I think people need to draw their lines, know which ones are worth fighting for, and the free speech, the free exercise is, but standing up for Jesus Christ was the primary motivation for all that. So draw your lines and be prepared to defend them.
Jack Phillips, owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop in Colorado, along with Jonathan Scruggs, we should mention it. It certainly bears emphasis. Alliance for Defending Freedom, also a heroic organization in this story, standing up and providing the legal counsel for Jack Phillips that would otherwise be unaffordable, the quality of legal counsel he's gotten over the last decade. So public interest law firms like Alliance for Defending Freedom, really important in this discussion. Jonathan,
and I'd like to
point out,
too, that Alliance Defending Freedom represents all their clients pro bono. So they have never charged me a dime, but it's not free. So if anybody's looking for a place to send some money, ADF is a great site.
Yeah, I assume that Jonathan Scruggs isn't drawn the $1,000 an hour criminal defense attorney retainers. Support these lawyers at places like Alliance for Defending Freedom and the others that we've talked about in this show before, too. Alliance for Defending Freedom is the organization. Jack Phillips, owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop. If you're in the Colorado area, stop in for a cupcake or something and support Jack Phillips. Jack, an honor to talk to you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Andy, join us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Scott, the cow guy, Chalady, did such a good job today. He's invited back tomorrow.
I did such a good job that nobody's around tomorrow, so I'll come back.
Exactly.
It's East.
I did such a good job.
Good Friday.
That he's my only option, and so he'll be back on Friday.
So, I'll be here.
And we'll be talking February jobs numbers, at least for such. So we'll have an expert in studio. Now we check the headlines with Mike Scott, who will also be here.